Hello, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Diane Finkhausen, founder and CEO of Shoshenworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. In this series, brought to you by Shoshenworks in collaboration with NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, we're exploring these new ecosystemic models and impacts. And over the next three episodes, we're investigating the exciting and expanded role that space plays in shaping the future of our planet and the human experience. In this episode, we'll explore the threats, challenges, and opportunities that are necessitating the growth of the space economy. What activated our history of space exploration, and why is it accelerating now? What role does space play in planning for the future of humanity? We're extremely fortunate to be joined today by two of the world's leading futurists in aerospace and the space economy. I couldn't be more pleased to introduce Vikram Shyam as my co-host today. Vic, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
I've been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. I've got a background in propulsion, biomimicry, and foresight. And relating to foresight and our guest today, so many people trying to focus just on utopian or dystopian futures, like how's AI going to take our jobs, or future Star Trek-like economies, or everyone's doing whatever they like. But it's usually more complex, more nuanced. And so Isaac, who's our guest today, does a great job of painting this more complex future. And I'm really looking forward to hearing the future and the role of aviation and aerospace. So back to you, Dan.
Thanks, Vic. I am so excited about this conversation today. So as Vic mentioned, joining us today is our guest, Isaac Arthur, president of the National Space Society, a futurist and host of the popular YouTube channel Science and Futurism with Isaac Arthur. Welcome, Isaac.
Great to be here today, Diane and Vic. Recently got elected as the president of the National Space Society, which came to me as a great surprise and a great honor. And it's after doing 9 years of my show, which is focused on futurism in general, but with probably a biggest large focus on space exploration and development itself. So it was a wonderful fit, and it's a great role to be in. And it's just a wonderful chance to share with so many people how much there is for us in a future in space, and to have gotten to find out on my end that this isn't just a niche topic a handful of us are interested in, but rather that there are millions of people who love this topic and are looking forward to us having a potential future in space.
This topic has fascinated millions for generations, but it really seems like we're entering a renaissance moment in the space economy, and we're fortunate to be here to see it, and Isaac, to have folks like you thinking about what it means for humanity. So you've had an amazing journey, and your work, Isaac, is absolutely fascinating. So before we dive into kind of some of the exciting principles of deep space exploration and other planets, let's maybe first start talking about ours. We've witnessed a lot of world-changing events and taking place over the last few years, the last few decades. And it really, we're seeing a strong shift in the growth of the space economy. So what does that mean? In your opinion, Isaac, what are some of the more significant events, problems, and challenges that you think are accelerating the exploration of and expansion into space? And maybe couple that with your thoughts regarding what the risk landscape is as we start to expand our exploration of space.
I'd say two that really stick out to me, of course, and in my mind, they're coupled together, is SpaceX and the overall morale we have towards space, the enthusiasm levels. And as a good example of this is I keep track of all the bits of the future that I've predicted and was completely wrong about. And like a lot of folks, when SpaceX was talking about commercializing space and doing all these big things, I applaud the concept, hope they get it done, but really didn't think it was very likely to pull off. We were getting kind of jaded after a post-Apollo period of great expectations and progress, but always very small progress. And so beyond being very glad to have been very wrong about SpaceX, I'm particularly glad about them because they helped in me too reignite this feeling that the future could be in our lifetimes, not just one of those things that happens 2, 3, 4 centuries down the road, but something we might actually get to see and enjoy in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetimes, not a distant future. And those to me are the two biggest things, because that forward piece of progress and that response of people building back up that love, that hope, that dream is what's going to actually make this a reality. The two of these things together. We've seen that. We've seen so many other people starting to venture into commercial exploration of space as potential development of space. Plans are getting more thorough. Plans are getting more developed. They're getting to be approached by investors who are no longer just saying, look, if it's in space, I'm not even interested in hearing about it. And these are often investors who love space, but they want to invest in it, but they can't see the path to investment to actually getting a decent ROI. And that's changing now. We are getting to a point where people have become convinced that future is not just desirable, but in our lifetimes, and something that could potentially be economically viable. And that to me is the biggest shift in the landscape in this whole generation. If the public feels sentiment, if we have an accident in space, there's a limitation on that. Things like nuclear propulsion space, that's a hard sell to folks. That's a lot easier if you can source and do all that off on the moon, for instance, even though that would be so much harder to do. But then you have your shuttle explosions, your rocket that blows up on the pad. Those can set you back a lot, and those are obviously avoidable errors, but if you put too much emphasis into avoiding them, you can also set yourself back by having too much inertia you need to overcome for every launch, as it were. At the same time, the biggest challenge, I think, if I had to say, would be just trying to find a way to get these rockets while we're using them to be to that point where it's more like a Boeing 747, where the cost is mostly the fuel to fly each time, not the maintenance, where we're getting that zone instead of where reusability is still requiring so much more actual cost. How do we get those aerospace levels of manufacturing precision, but get those more like naval sea type levels of actual production in terms of just being able to push the ships out quickly?
What about in terms of collaboration and cooperation? We're seeing a lot of, if you look at the changing landscape today, there's a lot of geopolitical conflicts. There's this new talk about currency, the BRIC currency coming up. But when it comes to space exploration, traditionally you've relied on cooperation. It's a multinational effort. There's bigger risk that impacts many nations. It's not just one nation. So what do you think is the role of, I guess, openness, collaboration, that kind of a model for exploration?
I think the approach I take to this is, because this is outside of our control, the geopolitical situation is going to be something the space community never really gets to have much of a say in, is the reminder that I think we do phenomenal with collaboration, and we'll still continue to collaborate with Russia, for instance, even as we have those obvious tensions now. But competition helps too. We also did very well. We were competing against Russia and vice versa. If it can be peaceful, or principally peaceful, I'll take competition, or I'll take collaboration, or both. They're both healthy. If they can be, again, too much collaboration where one side's getting unfairly used up, or too much competition where one side's getting cutthroat, possibly literally, those aren't, in my mind, very helpful. But they're always part of a system to some degree. But if we can keep to a good-spirited feeling that all the world benefits by this, then I think you will see, whether it's competition or collaboration, that we get a bit of the best of both worlds in both cases.
How do you come up with your futures? How do you come up with these notions of either like space tethers, or what's an economy going to look like 200 years from now? Do you sit around a coffee table chatting with friends, or are you doing calculations, or do you have some kind of formal process?
All of the above, not as much of a formal process these days. I think the more years I do this, it'll be more formal. And it's probably there in the background as a million little steps I do that I don't even think about anymore. But, you know, I've been fascinated by this topic since I was a little kid. I used to watch my Star Trek The Next Generation and my Doctor Who Tom Baker era when I was a kid, and it got me really invested in stuff. And then, little known fact, I dropped out of high school when I was 12. So I spent the next few years till I started college just reading sci-fi as voraciously as I could get it. Every audiobook I could find, and every other book that wasn't on audio. And then when I went to college for physics, I did a lot of my coffee table chats with everyone I could find who was interested in the topic. Probably the biggest source of continuing information I get with this, the constant brainstorming I get with this, isn't even from sci-fi books anymore these days, or from doing calculations or reading old papers. And again, a lot of these ideas, they're not mine. They're from other people originally. But a lot of times they're from other people in the audience who I still get to chat with on our forums that we maintain for the show, or on the comments on the shows, who come up with these ideas. They've been listening to me on the show for 9 years now, and they're brilliant, and they come up with brilliant new ideas. And that is probably one of the best parts of my day is getting to see or hear or read those brilliant new ideas coming up on the screen saying, hey, what if we did X instead, and saying that really would make way more sense. And sometimes looking at some concept that's from the 70s or 80s and was brilliant then and still is today, sometimes it's someone who just came up with it last week and we decide, let's do an episode on it. And it is just that idea that you have such a broad ecosystem of ideas that there is no shortage of them. As we say about the future, the cool thing about it, especially if you want to do shows on the future, is that there's always so much more of it. And the same is true for ideas about it.
I love that concept. We spent a lot of time exploring open models and experimenting with open models and ecosystemic kind of operations. And it's just, you can accomplish so much more if you start to open up the dialogue and the discovery. And I think honestly that the exploration of space and envisioning kind of what role space could play in the future of humanity is something that we all own, right? I mean, the geopolitical boundaries here on Earth, to what degree will those transcend, our own planet as we start to reach further into the future that space holds for us. So it'll be, I think, interesting as we move into this much bigger dimension together, what that means for our space and our communities here on Earth. But I love that you have a very open and collaborative approach to the futures and I'm so grateful for the work that you're doing on space futures. It's just fascinating work. As we think about that continued exploration and discovery into space, you have just some amazing material out there, Isaac. What do you think as our discovery of and development of space matures, what do you think that we're ready for what we might find? Are there any potentially unintended consequences that we might be triggering in this exploration, by exploring kind of this incredible space on a divided basis, right? So do we need to be more collaborative across nations in the discovery and the development, more collaborative across industries, or is the current approach, which is a reflection of how we operate here on Earth, is the current approach, likely to achieve the intended outcomes? What are we not ready for?
I think there's so many ways we could say, what are we not ready for? And that could include, oops, we accidentally poked the space monsters, the Kraken has come to eat our ships, or, hey, we didn't even notice you guys were there now, but now that you have radio, we'd like to come by for a visit. And by the way, welcome to our empire. There are alternatives you don't want to join, but you won't like them either. There are so many, Pandora's box is a classic tale of all mythology, and it shows up in various forms in so many other traditions too. And it is this idea that it's not just if you open this box, there will be trouble. Don't open it. It's saying, at least in my eyes, you're going to open that box. So be aware that when you do, many great wonders will appear from it. And a lot of it is going to require us to change, obviously, how we operate on this planet, how we operate outside this planet, how we operate with each other. That's one of those big things we say is, let's explore space so that you can go and settle new worlds, and then we don't have all of our eggs in one basket. And say, well, to be honest, even a local supernova isn't going to wipe us out at this point in time. We have ways to survive until the ozone will replenish. What could wipe us out is other intelligent life, e.g. each other. And the thing about when you export humanity to new worlds is you export humanity to new worlds, which is bringing along all the major problems we have with us. So in some ways, space does not offer solutions of the variety people often hope for. I don't think that we're going to be all that super peaceful race just because of space. At the same time, I do feel like these new frontiers often can actually set off their own types of new conflicts that we saw with history during the settlement colonial age of sail era. But at the same time, when people have some new place to go, and in this case, one that is presumably unpopulated already when they get there, that does become a bit of a release valve for problems. You have a new frontier to explore and unify around. And we say one of those questions comes with geopolitics is, what is the purpose of a nation? And that could be maybe to maintain a culture, maintain an idea, maybe it's for mutual self-defense. Space is one of those situations that says to us, do we really need to be some unified humanity to go and do space? And we say, well, we would do this so much better if we were. I'm not sure that's the case, but more importantly, I don't know that it matters. What holds nations together is some purpose, whether it's to protect yourself from others or to go solve space. In the absence of those purposes, those things kind of fall apart into additional entities. And I think that's what we're going to see a lot with space, is trying to redefine what the purpose of nations is. Because as we get to that point where global conflicts really are not viable at a very intense level, I think you do start seeing people looking at the what holds our country together as a trade, resource development, and exploration out to get those new resources, new frontiers. So I think that might become the reason why space becomes a much bigger piece of the platform, kind of as it was during the space race. And that encourages me to some degree, but at the same time, I would say the biggest threat, biggest unexpected aspect to us, besides obviously the possibility of alien life, or also the possibility that we find out there is no alien life, is going to be trying to figure out how do we redefine all those Earth-based last few centuries of global travel and instant communication. How do we redefine the status quo and the stable, safe place? Because it's when civilizations feel stable that they feel most peaceful. And when somebody feels like they have a lot of unknowns or uncertainties, that they tend to bottle up more and get a little bit more paranoid and a little bit more belligerent in some cases too, in my own humble amateur opinion. So I think that's the biggest threat of space to us that we might not be expecting, is that it could destabilize us a bit back here just from changing so many paradigms about what economic stability is in place.
Just to add on to, or maybe to ask you a question related to what you're saying here, you started off by talking about SpaceX and the morale boost, I guess, that it gives, and reigniting your hopes for maybe bringing the future closer to us in some ways, and then the commercial investments. And now you're talking about motivating factors for humanity to go to space. I think maybe it's not survival. Maybe it's not that scatter or adapt philosophy. It's we just need more resources, need to spread out, the kind of stuff. Are there other things that you think are driving space exploration? Any trends that you're seeing in terms of the space industry? And
psychologically, I'd say there are a lot of things that drive it. I mean, humans are basically programmed when we're part of a tribal group to want, if we don't feel like we have a particular path in that group at that moment, to go off and explore, maybe to come back later on. But, you know, you may go to find out and try. That always drives exploration. That's one of those ones that we can tap in definitely for space. We always have like three basic concepts that dominate the logical approach. You say, what resources or things are only in space for us to do? And one example of that would be things that you can only produce in microgravity, so in ceramics or semiconductors. Another thing would be, what is preferable in space? And so if you, maybe it's easier to do on Earth, where we already have all of our industry out in the first place, but you'd rather do it up there. Solar power might be an example of that. We do that on the ground, but it gets dark and cloudy here at times. So you might prefer space-based solar power. Same for certain minerals that you might rather extract there than here, because you don't really care if you turn the moon into a toxic waste dump. And then you have those things that you can only do in space because of the sheer scale. And that, to me, is the long-range one. That's, you don't start off with space development for the purpose of expanding the human population there. That's way down the road. But ultimately, space is big. Space is really big. So that's your third factor. What can only be done in space? What do you prefer to do in space? And then what can only be done in space because of the sheer immensity of it? And that's step three, as it were. That's down the road.
Makes sense. Your comments on the turn moon into toxic waste, I guess some people might push back against that. If we're going to settle there, isn't that what we've done? You talked about historically how we migrated, and then eventually we've had regrets over how we migrated, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And even the types of cities and infrastructure we built, it's like some of the ancient port cities, they were built to satisfy sailors or tradesmen and merchants. And then eventually, when you start to get families, you start to get different kinds of professions, you need to rethink what you've done in the past. And
so is that growing pains. Yeah. Well, we'll have them for space. I'm certain of that. You're going to have growing pains for space. Someone's going to negotiate a treaty that is seems like a great one at the time, and then you realize, wait a minute, this was incredibly stupid. And then it's like, well, we don't want to follow that treaty anymore. And people say, well, we acknowledge it was definitely not fair to you, but we'd like you to keep following it anyway. This is part of humanity. It has nothing to do with space in itself. This is who we are. We are wanderers, we are explorers, and we are at times bullies. And those are often, sadly, linked hand in hand. a lot of times when I'll explore, when we've been exploring, we've actually been incredibly peaceful and kind about it. And we should not forget those times. Well, at the same time, we obviously don't want to forget those occasions we've been jackals. And the nice thing again about space is, as best as we can tell right now, it is unoccupied. And that still says, well, what if we get to some planet, there's no intelligent life there, but it turns out there's like an algae. What do we do about that? And do we need to study the heck out of that thing? And I said, well, we're going to try to colonize over top. He's like, well, no, probably not. We'll probably fight for the right to medically examine that algae because it might have insane amounts of value to biology and chemistry and industry. But either way, there was a very good chance of not being the best stewards in space either. But am I mining in such a way I'm this asteroid that I fling out debris that can help set off Kessler syndrome in the solar system at large? These are concerns that will happen. But as I say, we try to look in the future and say what the future problems and challenges and benefits are, but we don't try to overdo it either because there are going to be things we can't predict. There need to be the thing for the future. Don't try to guide the future with a dead hand. That the people of the future figure out their own problems. It's their test, their trial. And if they're not up for it, then they're not up for it and we go away. That might be a great tragedy, but you have to have those challenges because solving those challenges is some way what defines us positively, at least, as something worthy as a species. But there's the practical reality of it is ethically, you can't dictate everything for the past. So we want to be very careful in our approach to these things, be mindful that we're trying to spot good problems and solutions for the future, but not necessarily to tie the hands of those who'll be handling it in the future either.
So well said. I think we imagine the role that space plays in our future versus humanity. It absolutely necessitates really futurists like yourself, Isaac, who are anticipating the realm of possibilities and helping the rest of us to make better decisions, right, and to design for better outcomes. Knowing that we'll have some lessons learned in that journey, but trying to minimize the negative, potentially negative outcomes of those. But Vic, your thoughts regarding this key takeaways from this discussion before we put a wrap on it for this one?
Just like we have in the past, we're going to make some mistakes, but probably we'll overcome them. So there's no great filter implications here.
Hopefully. Well, we have those late filters, we call them, the ones we haven't hit yet on the Fermi paradox, and they fall into two categories. Either space travel is way harder than we think it is, or we are way less qualified to do it and survive for the next 3 centuries, I think we are. And there may be a million planets in this galaxy that are burned out husks of civilizations that reached too far, and as Icarus had it, burnt their wings and fell to the ground. I don't think so myself, but I never rule that possibility out. So
I think we'll discover those possibilities as we extend our reach. But with that, where did the half hour go? So we'll have to put a wrap on the conversation here, but to be continued. And Isaac, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. Thank you for sharing your insight in space, into space, which is basically the ultimate ecosystem, the ultimate new market development for those of us in the commercial arena, which basically just opens up really an abundance of discovery and potential development for our society, industry, policy, and humanity in the years and decades to come. We're shifting this sphere squarely from sci-fi into basically our future. And for our listeners out there, please do make sure to check out our next two podcast episodes, where we'll continue this conversation with Vic and Isaac about space, the threats and opportunities, and the potential solutions that lie outside and beyond our planet. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to catch podcasts, and you can always learn more at shoshanworks.com. Thanks, everyone.